May it please the court, Mr. Walker. This case involves five instances of professional misconduct stipulated to by the parties and found by the disciplinary hearing panel. The misconduct taken together reflects a troublesome indifference on the part of the respondent to basic law practice management issues to which any practicing lawyer should be sensitive. The violations run the gamut from respondent's marketing and advertising practices to communication issues, to the failure to promptly deliver trust funds belonging to a third party. The violations include the unauthorized practice of law during two brief periods of administrative suspension and a failure to initially cooperate with the disciplinary authority. Overlaying these violations is the fact that respondent received an admonition in 2007 after her unsuccessful participation in a diversion agreement with the Office of Chief Disciplinary Counsel. Notwithstanding these multiple instances of misconduct, informant believes that the violations can be properly addressed by suspending respondent from the practice of law, staying that suspension, and placing her on probation for a sufficient period in order to permit the OCDC to monitor her law practice and to educate her regarding law practice management issues. The informant believes that this sanction will adequately protect the public and the integrity of the bar. Arguably, the most serious misconduct in this case involves respondent's failure to promptly remit third-party funds in her trust account to the Institute for Financial Literacy, a consumer credit counseling agency that contracted with respondent to provide credit counseling services to her bankruptcy clients. Respondent routinely collected $50 fees from each client for these services. Respondent ended up in a contractual dispute with the Institute over the amount due and owing. The parties stipulated in this case that the amount in controversy was $1,460. Respondent denied the Institute's claim of money owed but was unable to reconcile her trust records with those of the Institute in order to determine the proper amount due and owing. The circumstances of that conduct did not demonstrate a conscious objective or purpose on the part of the respondent to misappropriate trust funds. Respondent's failure to properly remit these third-party funds does not rise to the level of knowing and intentional conversion that
you
might...
You think it resulted from insufficient record-keeping as opposed to an intent?
That is what we concluded, was that there was no intent to convert, misappropriate, simply really bad record-keeping on Ms. Morris's part. Okay. That said, the informant believes that the respondent did sign an agreement under which she contractually agreed to collect this fee and to protect that fee so that it could be paid over to the Institute. Having accepted those responsibilities, respondent was required to keep track of the funds collected so as to reconcile her records with the Institute's records and promptly remit properly due and payable funds to the Institute. Under these circumstances, informant submits that respondent acted with knowing disregard of her professional responsibilities, and the party stipulated that that conduct violated Rule 4-1.15. The other violations, while factually diverse, reflect a common theme. Respondent was indifferent to her professional responsibilities to her clients and to the profession. She sent direct mail solicitation letters to potential bankruptcy clients without following some of the requirements set forth in Rule 4-7.3. She failed to adequately communicate with one of her bankruptcy clients regarding the specifics of the representation fee agreement in violation of Rule 4-1.4. She continued to practice law during two brief periods when she was administratively suspended due to her delinquency in meeting her continuing legal education requirements set by the bar. Finally, respondent initially failed to respond to the disciplinary authority's efforts to investigate two of the complaints filed against her in violation of Rule 4-8.1. Under the ABA standards, it is proper to, in assessing the appropriate sanction, to consider aggravating and mitigating circumstances. In this case, the parties stipulated, and we believe there are both aggravating and mitigating circumstances present. In aggravation, it should be considered that respondent, the presence of multiple offenses has occurred in this case. Respondent has a substantial experience in the practice of law, and she was issued a prior admonition by the Office of Chief Counsel. In mitigation, She has displayed a cooperative attitude with the disciplinary authority during the formal disciplinary proceedings. There's an absence of dishonest or selfish motive, and she has shown remorse for
what exactly, upon reconciliation, what exactly happened to the money that was collected that was supposed to be paid for those fees? Did she receive any of that money that was client funds for her own benefit?
I believe that the money has not been paid over, but it also has not been taken for her own benefit. There is still this dispute that arises as to what is due and owing. It's my understanding that's the case.
Is that on the bankruptcy case?
This is on the Institute.
The Institute?
Disagreement with the Institute.
And that's still being worked out?
It's still in controversy.
Well, I mean, there's either funds there in the account to pay them or they were paid to someone.
I believe that the funds remain in the account, although I will defer to Mr. Walther on that issue. The final issue in mitigation is respondent's remorse, which she has clearly shown in her brief and during the formal proceedings. What then is the appropriate sanction for respondent's professional misconduct? Consideration of the sanction model provided by the ABA standards support a recommendation of suspension, in our view, when a lawyer knows or should know that she is dealing improperly with third-party funds. Consideration of the respondent's mental state, the harm caused by her misconduct, the relevant aggravating and mitigating circumstances would suggest a period of suspension, if not far, her eligibility for probation under Rule 5.225. After careful consideration, informant believes that the facts in this case satisfy the criteria for probation under that rule. Respondent is clearly competent in practicing bankruptcy law and is able to continue in the practice of bankruptcy law to provide legal services for her clients on those matters. The violations in this case, while clearly significant, don't demonstrate the type of conduct that involves dishonesty or a lack of personal integrity. For the first 15 years as a licensed attorney, it should be noted that respondent was not the subject of any complaints and received no discipline. Finally, probation will not cause the profession to fall into disrepute and will give respondent an opportunity to rectify the harm she's done to the profession. Most recently, in the Coleman case, this court held that probation is appropriate when professional misconduct can be remedied by education and supervision. The inappropriate written solicitation of clients, the inadequate communication with clients, the improper handling of trust funds, future compliance with MCLE requirements can all be monitored by our office and remedied by education and supervision. As a result, the informant believes that probation is proper and that respondent is eligible for probation under Rule 5.225.
Keeping in mind her graduated scale of discipline and her prior disciplinary history, do you think probation is appropriate in light of that?
I do, Judge Russell. When she was under a diversion agreement, it was terminated for her failure to comply with it, and as we do often in the cases where we terminate a diversion agreement, we issued an admonition to her. In my view, at this point, probation, while it gives us that opportunity to monitor, supervise, and educate, but by the same token, in this case, were she to violate those terms, she would be subject to a revocation of that probation and an actual suspension, which to me is hopefully enough of a stick to basically make sure that she complies and receives the education and training that she should receive, frankly. So in our view, even under a graduated approach to discipline that we follow, it's the appropriate discipline in the case. In this case, in our view, the conditions of probation should be those recommended by the panel and stipulated to by the parties, which only, frankly, involved ethics school, attendance at ethics school, and no further violations of the rules. However, in addition to that, and prior to today's oral argument, in speaking with respondent's counsel, Mr. Walther, we've agreed that should the court approve a state suspension with probation, that probation should include the following additional terms: appointment of an attorney mentor for Ms. Morse, preparation of an office practice management plan approved by the OCDC, quarterly reporting to the Office of Chief Counsel regarding her law practice, something we always, almost always require, and periodic financial audits of her trust account, as well as obviously any other conditions deemed necessary and appropriate by this court.
Has the OCDC audited her trust account?
We have not.
So you have no idea the condition of the trust account?
only that she was unable to reconcile her records enough to pay the institute, to know what she even owed the institute.
And do we know whether or not the disputed funds are currently available in her trust account?
Only based on representation by Ms. Morrison and her counsel.
There's been no allegation that they're not, though.
That's correct.
There's no allegation suggesting otherwise.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
There's no suggestion or evidence to suggest that there's anything been misappropriated. We have no other client complaints from anyone saying she owes me money that I haven't received, except for the institute. Unless there's any other questions, I will give the podium to Mr. Walther. Thank you.
May it please the court. I was only recently retained in this case, and so my command of the facts is not what I would like. But it does appear that there's no dispute as to the various rule violations that Mr. Prassel has alerted you to in his brief and has discussed here today. And they are multiple violations. I would submit, however, that most of the violations are inattentive in nature or negligent. There are a couple that are problematic, the one that Mr. Prassel has focused on is clearly, at least in my view, the most difficult to deal with, and that is the trust fund issue involving the Institute for Financial Independence. I think that's the name of the company. The record is not crystal clear on exactly what happened, and I hope that I have the latitude to embellish upon that in this proceeding. The law changed, the bankruptcy law changed in 2005, as I understand it, and the federal government required people going through bankruptcy to engage in client credit counseling sessions as well as some educational program. And that created a cottage industry of companies that were offering those services and would contact bankruptcy counsel to provide those services. In this particular case, my client entered into an agreement, which I would never advise an attorney to enter into, but she did, and it obligated her to collect funds for the Institute and transmit those funds to the Institute as the Institute provided service to her client, rather than the Institute directly invoicing, which is really what should have happened. But she agreed to it, and there were two components to it. There was a $50 fee that was to be collected when the client was retained, when Ms. Morse was retained by the client. That money was then to go to the Institute for the credit counseling service. My understanding is the $50 component for credit counseling went into my client's escrow account and in every single instance went to the Institute. There was a second component that created the problem, and the second component was paid by the client over time because these clients, as I understand it, don't pay their entire fee to Ms. Morse up front. They pay in installments. And many clients come in and pay cash. And as I understand it, the second component, the second $50 fee that was due the Institute would be paid through the installment process of a client paying a lawyer either cash or check. But there was no segregation of the component and probably not even any identification as to what the money was to be used for. So my client would collect fees from her clients, and I believe those monies went into her general operating account, not her escrow account, because the bulk of that money was her fee. I think it's probably fair to say that a part of those payments should have been escrowed. And I believe under the rule that if money comes into an attorney's possession and part of that money is owed to a third person, then the entire amount should be segregated so you can figure out who's entitled to what.
But you're saying, if I understand it correctly, because it didn't all come through in the pleadings, she did not agree to, she did not personally owe this money to the Institute. She agreed to be a conduit for payment from her client to the Institute, and the clients would owe her money and the Institute money, and she allocated that money to her, and the Institute said no, some of that should have been allocated to them.
That's correct.
Okay.
And I think it's fair to say, as far as I can understand it, that some of the money that she collected that went into her general operating account belonged to the Institute and wasn't repaid to the Institute. But it's unfortunate, I have to admit, my client's record keeping was shoddy enough that she can't tell you what component should have been hers and what component should have been the Institute's. It's also true, as I understand it, that some of her clients did not fully pay her and would have received the Institute's services. And so it creates an accounting nightmare for somebody who's not very good at accounting. The point is not, I'm not trying to diminish my client's culpability in terms of failing to abide by the rule. I do think, however, that my client's conduct was neglectful, inattentive, and failed to rise to the level that lawyers are expected to provide or perform. So I'm not debating at all the rule violation, only that this was not one of those cases where an attorney was taking money out of their trust account and paying their utility bill or their mortgage expense. It wasn't that at all. It's just that she didn't do a good job of paying attention to the monies that were given to her partially for the Institute and partially for her.
What's her justification for continuing to practice during the times where she had the month-long suspensions?
Well, that's a good question, and it's a troublesome one for me. My understanding is that she didn't appreciate the consequence of her failure to provide or to complete the CLE requirements. My understanding is that she got the notice, but that she didn't appreciate the gravity of. I mean, that's as best as I can give it to you, Judge. It's a troublesome question. Fortunately, it was for a brief period of time, and fortunately, she was able to correct the CLE requirement. Now, I would respectfully submit that just as there shouldn't be any dispute as to whether discipline should be imposed, because discipline certainly is required in this case. The question is whether it should be a reprimand, suspension, or disbarment. And I would also submit that a reprimand is clearly inappropriate in this case, given the multitude of violations, a prior instance of discipline, and the nature of the violations, particularly involving money owed to the Institute. And I think the second one that concerns me the most is practicing law when she didn't have a license to do so. Fortunately, I think it's fair to say that her mental state with respect to most of these violations was either an inattention to what she's supposed to be doing or negligence. But just as reprimand is inappropriate, I also believe that disbarment is equally inappropriate. As this court knows, disbarment is reserved only for severe misconduct where it is clear that the attorney is not fit to continue in the profession. And there are, this court deals with this issue regularly, and I'm sure you're aware of the many instances of conduct that is deceitful, dishonest, fraudulent, and doesn't result in disbarment. And of course, those I would submit that those issues are not present in this case.
Can you address suspension versus state suspension?
I would, because obviously, if suspension is the issue, then the question is, should probation be granted or not? And I would submit that probation is appropriate under the ABA standards. If the attorney is unlikely to harm the public during the probationary period, if the attorney is able to perform legal services without detriment to the profession, and if the attorney has not committed acts warranting disbarment, then probation is appropriate. The Coleman case, as Mr. Pratzel has cited in his brief and is discussed here today, I believe involves more egregious conduct than what my client committed. And in the Coleman case, I believe that he had a prior admonition or two prior admonitions and a reprimand, and nevertheless, and he also was spending money out of his trust account, paying bills directly out of his trust account. He was suspended and placed on probation. And so If that's the yardstick by which this case is to be judged, then I would submit that probation would be consistent. An order of probation would be consistent, certainly, with the Coleman case. Also, the Wiles case, which is 107 Southwest 3rd 228, which was a 2003 case decided by this court, the record is not very clear because a lot of the misconduct was referenced in a Kansas opinion that I did not download. But apparently, Mr. Wiles violated the rules with respect to diligence, communication, fees, safekeeping property, competence, and he had multiple priors. He was given suspension and probation. And so, again, from a consistency standpoint, and certainly I know this court is very concerned about that, I would submit that probation would be appropriate given the results in those two cases, as well as what I think is true in this case. My client, while she has committed multiple violations of the rules over a three-year period of time, does understand the significance of what she's done, is making an effort to rehabilitate herself, is trying to conform her conduct to the standards that we require and expect. And so I would hope that this court would consider probation with the terms that Mr. Pratzel has discussed with you today. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I just want to make sure that I understand the trust fund situation. She wrote no inappropriate checks out of the trust fund.
That is my understanding.
And the only failing was the failing to remit to the bankruptcy counseling company monies that might have been due from installment payments.
That is correct. I can see how it occurred. If a client comes in with $200 and she's owed $200 and the institute is owed another $50, does she take $150 and put it in her operating and put $50 in her escrow and transfer it to the institute, or does she pay all $200? And I think that's pretty much what happened. Over the course of time, however, what I think it's fairly clear happened is that some of these clients paid her in full and paid the institute, and she just didn't have the record-keeping acumen to recognize that she had been
double billing it.
I guess that's a fair way of putting it. And I, you know, that's just not excusable. It's just inappropriate. But it wasn't intentional. It wasn't, I'm stealing this money. She's just not she just wasn't paying attention to what she should have been paying attention to.
Thank you. Any further questions?
I just have a concern that she was previously on suspension, and then now the OCDC is asking us to basically put her on suspension again with probation for some of the same things that she was previously on suspension for. It seems like you're putting a person on a probation who has got a prior.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the prior matter was an admonition from OCDC. It did not involve a suspension.
You're correct.
It was an admonition having to do with a case involving an unreasonable fee, and there was supposed to be a mediation that occurred, and for whatever reason, that process failed. And because that process, the mediation process, failed, an employee of OCDC sent a letter to my client admonishing her for failing to perform that. So while it is a prior instance of discipline, as a prior instance noted on her record, I would submit that it is not the same thing for which we are here today to discuss.
It was not a reprimand. It was an admonition.
It was just an admonition from Mr. Schaefer-Cotter, actually.
Okay.
Thank
yes.
you.
Yeah.
But she was also suspended for not having enough CLE requirements.
Yes, that was the issue, actually twice, two administrative suspensions, one in 2008 and one in 2009. Mm-hmm. But for about a 30-day period in each instance. But yes, those were suspensions that were administrative in nature. Mm-hmm. And please accept my apologies. My client is an attorney in Kansas City, and I understand the weather prevented her from attending today. Thank you.
Just a couple of brief points. Just to clarify, the prior admonition from our office, which was issued by us, was as a result of a terminated diversion agreement, not as a result of any, no suspension was involved with regard to that conduct. We put her under diversion because it was a law practice management violation that we thought, again, through simply monitoring, we could handle. There was a specific requirement in that diversion agreement that she failed to comply with, and as a result, we terminated it and admonished her.
And diversion is something, this is prior to the discipline process?
That's correct. There was a finding that of a violation. However, we thought it could be addressed through diversion. Had she successfully completed the diversion agreement, she would have come out at the other end with no admonition or discipline from this court. Okay. That's correct. Judge Russell, you're correct. There was a prior administrative, two administrative suspensions. There really is very little justification for continuing to practice during those periods, except perhaps her own ignorance about what was required of her in terms of stopping the practice. The only thing I would point out with regard to those administrative suspensions is they were very brief. The first one began on March 4th, 2008, and ended on April 17th, 2008. The second one started on March 2nd, 2009, and ended on April 1st, 2009. And I can tell you that there are a lot of lawyers who get suspended administratively and don't address their CLE requirements as quickly as she did. So the failing came in that she didn't realize that, well, for whatever reason, that she should stop practicing. To me, the case simply calls out for a lot of training and education about use of trust accounts, operating accounts, the interrelationship between the two. We can provide that. We do that all the time. And in our view, this is a case that should be sent to probation with a state suspension. Any questions? Thank you all.
Thank you. The case is taken under submission.